live from New York, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Got my mojo working, but I just don't work on you. Got my mojo working, but
I'm Gary Null, and I'd like to welcome you to this program. Today, the latest on how to lessen your chance of a cardiovascular event, like a heart attack or a stroke. Did you ever look at your hospital bill and wonder, whoa, why is this simple, inexpensive blood test so exorbitantly expensive? We'll discuss that. Even in nonprofit hospitals. 10 common household plants that are harmful to your pets. Good for you, not for your pets. The omega-3 fatty acids can guard against a repeated bad condition. I'll tell you what that is. And make sure that your kids are getting vitamin D. I'll explain why. And a lot more on health and healing. Also, we'll look at 8 forgettable survival skills that your grandparents, or forgotten skills that your grandparents used every day. And I'll share those with you because I'm sure some of those you'll be able to appreciate even today. From our environmental segment, the Food and Water Watch calls on the FDA to declare GMO salmon unsafe to eat. Well, how would you know if you're eating GMO salmon in a restaurant? You wouldn't. I'll explain. Our guest in the second part of our program, Alan Phillips, is one of the toughest attorneys in America when it comes to defending the rights of parents not to vaccinate. We're going to talk about why the vaccine community refuses to openly discuss vaccine safety and efficacy, and the other strategies necessary to empower the vaccine opponents. And we have a lot more, including some commentaries. We're going to deal with holding a grudge. Not a good idea. You have no idea what it does to your body. All bad. So you walk around with an attitude, some emotional distemper. You pay a price for that. Also, 10 reasons why you should eat local, and Big Pharma generates $77 billion in revenue for every $1 million they give to corrupt politicians. Also, a report lists the Grand Canyon's Colorado rivers as the most imperiled. So we'll talk about that. And the greatest mass extinction in history was driven by what? Acid oceans, acidic oceans. Isn't that what's going on now? Yes, it is. So we could be looking at another mass extinction based upon not paying attention to the acidity of our oceans. So let's begin. First and foremost, from King's College London, a good study showing that men and women who adapt their daily diet to be healthy can substantially, quote, reduce their risk of a heart attack or a stroke by up to a third. The study, published in the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition, recruited healthy middle-aged and older men and women to compare the effects on risk factors for cardiovascular disease by following a good diet. In a randomized controlled trial, they measured blood pressure, vascular function, CVD risk factors like cholesterol in all of these men and women. Those who had the healthiest diet had a 33% less likelihood of having a heart attack or stroke. So that's simple. That's not difficult. We know what a healthy diet is. It's just that most people prefer, the average person prefers, foods that are not healthy. I was shocked to see how much it cost to spend a day in a hospital in the United States. Just a normal procedure. We're not talking about intensive care or surgeries. We're just talking about a day in a hospital and all the different ways they make money from you, even the nonprofits. This is from Natural News. Quote, the lipid panel is a simple, common blood test doctors use in modern medicine to measure a patient's cholesterol levels. These tests are ordered millions of times per year, and it's not an overly complicated process. And it's not a procedure where some hospitals are really great at lipid panels and others are terrible. It's standard. You're going to get the same feedback just about everywhere you go at any hospital in America. But here's the deal, which is why it is baffling, to say the least, that a lipid panel in California can cost anywhere between $10 and $10,000, since it's precisely the same test. Quote, what we are trying to see is, when we get down the simplest, most basic form of medicine, how much variation is there in price? This was a professor, University of California, San Francisco, who published the huge fee variations recently in the British Medical Journal, said, quote, it shows how big the variation really is. We're not talking about twofold or threefold differences. It is a completely different level of magnitude, end quote. They looked at the same identical blood test at 100 different hospitals. And it's not just the blood test. According to the study, charges range from $10 to $10,000. A hospital pricing for basic metabolic panels, which are dirt cheap to do, by the way, which doctors use to gauge a patient's metabolism, mainly diabetics, was $35 at one hospital and $7,000 in another hospital. Quote, for every blood test that the researchers looked at, they found pretty giant variations. This huge variation in the price of a really simple, incredibly basic blood test tells us a few things about the American healthcare system. End quote. Yeah, sure does. Oh, and by the way, an appendectomy without any complications, which is quick and easy to do, it's a simple procedure. It costs on the low end $1,529 to, in the high end, $186,000. Think of that for a moment. $1,500 or nearly $250,000. How in the world could you have such a variation? Now, one variable in this study is that different hospitals treated patients differently. They might use more IV bags. Okay, well, what does an IV bag cost? About a dollar. How much do they charge? They can charge $1,000. A dollar to produce $1,000 to charge the patient? Quote, while Fresno County had the smallest range of charges, the lowest and highest charges still differed by a remarkable $46,000. So that's what we're at in America today. And so when I get a blood chemistry done, which is about three times a year, everything I get done, and I get a full panel of everything, it's about $275 for everything. Today, and I don't get that in a hospital, I get it in a clinic, but today that would run you possibly as high as $100,000. There's no way in the world to justify it. No way except unmitigated greed. And everybody in that system is greedy. They're all making money, and hence there's no reform. Now, in this fool's game called Obamacare, and shame on the left for promoting it, because if they had any real care, they would say, well, is this going to prevent disease? No. Will this help people who are sick get better medical care? No. Will this allow people who want a more natural approach to helping their disease condition and their physician? Will that help them? It's not even mentioned. Well, what about the people who cannot afford the deductibles? Then they will go without the medical care. Well, couldn't that end up harming them? Yes, it could cause thousands of people to die. Shouldn't we just have one simple system where it's universal care like 27 other civilized countries have? So the person never has to judge whether or not they should have a procedure because they can't afford the deductible. Realistically, we should have universal health care. But as long as we have such corrupt sociopaths running our government at every level and equally corrupt technocrats who are enabling them, because politicians are not very bright, with a few exceptions, but the people around them are, and those are the technocrats. And then they know how to manipulate the bureaucrats and to be just nothing more than functionaries who can see a wrong but will not speak it. And so as a result, the entire system is one massive metastasizing cancer. So you can't reform it. It is not reformable because they control all mechanisms of reform. Therefore, it will never be reformed to where they can't still game the system. So we should start over and have a universal healthcare system, and therefore we could reform all of medicine. Now, by the way, do you realize how big medicine is today? Let me give you a perspective. Medicine is bigger than all of our education, all colleges, high schools, schools, put it all together. All of our food, put it all together. All of our military defense, put it all together. It's still bigger. You never hear that. $3.5 trillion a year. Insurance companies wrote Obamacare. Insurance companies wrote every single letter and every word of it. They control it. They will make trillions of dollars in profits. And yet it was sold as being important and benevolent and preventing people from dying, preventing people from not being covered. You want to do the right thing, it would cost a fraction because upwards of 35% of every dollar spent, that's over $1 trillion, is in bureaucracy and paperwork that's not needed. You eliminate that. You eliminate the profit in the system. That's $500 billion. You eliminate corruption and fraud in the system. That's another $400 billion. You eliminate defensive medicine and overtesting and overtreating. That's $200 billion. Now you've just saved $2 trillion a year. In 10 years, you know, you got $20 trillion that you wouldn't have had, and you got healthier people and no stress and no bankruptcies. 10 common household plants that are harmful to your pets. Now, mind you, these are good to you, so I'm not saying you shouldn't have these. I'm just saying don't let your pets eat these. Top of the list, aloe vera. Yes, it's good for all the things we know, from indigestion and ulcers and putting on the skin for burns and scrapes and helping the body heal. But the plant is toxic to your cats and dogs. They can vomit, have diarrhea. They end up with tremors. So don't let them eat your aloe vera. Then English ivy. Again, great on your house because it can insulate the whole house, making it cooler in the summer and warmer in the winter. I have English ivy over my entire house. Makes a big difference. I can't remember the last time I used either the heat or the air conditioning. But the sap contains a toxic triterpenoid, saponin, and you don't want them eating that. And then baby's breath. Baby's breath is, you know, it's wonderful to see. It's got the pretty colors, but it causes diarrhea and vomiting in your pet. And gladiolus. Gladiolus are wonderful. They're very vibrant. But the bulb is dangerous. Lilies. You don't want lilies. They're extremely toxic. And also poinsettias, pathos, and tomato plants. So keep those out, and begonias as well. All right? And that way it'll help your pet not get sick. But if for any reason your pet does ingest something that's a toxin, shouldn't, take some granulated charcoal and get it down their throats, 3 or 4 or 5. The charcoal will open up in their stomach, and since they have a highly acidic stomach, which is a low pH, it will help trap a lot of the toxins and get it out of the system. And then you want to flush their system. The quicker you flush the animal's system, getting it out, the less likely it's going to be absorbed and cause more serious danger, damage to them inside. And if you want to help guard against repeated stroke, omega-3 fatty acids. That's right, those wonderful polyunsaturated fatty acids, abundant in walnuts and flax and fish, can help protect stroke patients from suffering a second stroke. That's according to a study that was done in Japan at the Taiyama University Hospital. So they gave the omega-3 fatty acids to 9,000 patients, and then they followed them for a period of time, and saw those that had the highest level of the omega-3 fatty acids, about 1,800 milligrams a day, which to me is a low amount. I could easily see people doubling that. They had the lowest incidence of stroke. This was published in the peer-reviewed journal Stroke. So, in the morning, take your omega-3. Before you go to bed, take your omega-3. In fact, here's my formula for helping prevent a stroke or heart attack during the night when a lot of people have their stroke or heart attack. Garlic capsules or odorless garlic. Magnesium citrate, 800 milligrams, or up to bowel tolerance. Some people can take 1,000, 1,500, others not. They get a loose stool. So you determine what level, and then back it just below that. Vitamin C mixed topicals from vitamin E. Vitamin C, generally 1,000 to 1,500 milligrams. Vitamin E tocopherols, about 400 units. L-carnitine, and about 500 to 1,000 milligrams. Coenzyme Q10, 100 to 200 milligrams. And cayenne, anywhere from a low 40,000 heat unit capsule up to whatever you can tolerate. Mind you, it's not burning you, but it's doing great to thin the blood. It's one of the best things in the world for people who are having a heart attack. If you know someone who's having a heart attack, pop a high-level, high-heat-unit cayenne pepper along with magnesium. Get as much magnesium, like even 1,500. Don't worry about the diarrhea. That can be cleaned up. A heart that's in attack, could that kill you? And does. So cayenne, so always carry a little bottle if you feel that you are at risk. Carry a little tiny bottle. Have your cayenne, your vitamin E, and your magnesium in there. It can make all the difference in the world. And also, another good study on the omega-3 fatty acids found that, and this was published again in the journal Circulation, quote, high intake of the omega-3 fatty acids in oily fish and vegetable oils appears to prevent heart attacks. That's good. By as much as 59%. Wow. Quote, we compared those subjects who had heart attacks with those who did not have heart attacks, and they found that we found a relationship. And so make sure that you get your omega-3 fatty acids. By the way, the amount of omega-3 fatty acids you could get if you use flax would be about 1 teaspoon or about 6 to 10 walnut halves. That's just for perspective. And finally, on health, holding a grudge produces cortisol and diminishes oxytocin. Now, we know oxytocin's our love hormone. And we know that when we're petting our wonderful companion creature, whether it's a bird or a cat or a dog or horse, whatever it is, it actually secretes in us oxytocin and in the pet. That's why the more you pet a cat, the more the cat wants to be petted. And the same with a dog. And babies that are around pets, also, they had the mother and secreting the oxytocin. The mother secretes oxytocin when she breastfeeds. But the baby also secretes oxytocin. So by having these wonderful love bonds throughout life, it helps us. It de-stresses us. It helps our immune system. Just walking and holding someone's hand makes a big difference. You create oxytocin. Cuddling creates oxytocin. People thought that it was only sex. Yes, sex creates oxytocin, but cuddling also creates it as well. Being able just to be in the presence of someone that you care about creates oxytocin. So that's the good part of this. Here's the other side. This is from Christopher Berglund, Psychology Today. Quote, holding a grudge produces cortisol and diminishes oxytocin. Quote, we all know the psychological feelings created when you're blood is boiling, and you ruminate about ways to get even with someone who has hurt or betrayed you. Feelings of anger and revenge activate the fight-or-flight stress response of your sympathetic nervous system, which causes cortisol levels to spike. The stress response triggered by bitterness and rage also raises blood pressure and reduces the healthy tone of your vagus nerve and activates a feedback loop of distress that can damage your health. Are you currently holding a grudge against someone? Is someone holding a grudge against you? What was the transgression that led to the feelings of anger and resentment or the desire to seek revenge? Do you feel more like the perpetrator or the victim in this conflict? Are you in a position to apologize and make amends? Having a vendetta or holding a grudge is toxic. Over the long run, if you don't make conciliatory efforts to neutralize interpersonal conflicts, holding a grudge will wreak havoc inside your body. In many ways, holding a grudge is a form of self-sabotage. So, I thought that's important because a lot of people pride themselves on holding on to a strident or negative or self-righteous attitude. I was once asked to attend a local station board meeting of our sister station, WBI in New York, where I've been on the air for 39 years. And I came away just sensing people who, every person in that room, I'm sure, felt that their position, whatever they were advocating, was right. But it was the animus, it was the anger, it was the projecting of negative energy, the screaming, the demeaning, the personal attacks. And it was the entire time. And then when they weren't doing it, when the time for the audience to speak, they were doing it. And I thought, do any of these individuals realize that whether they're right or wrong on any given issue, and it wasn't for me to judge that, they're killing themselves. They're hastening their likelihood of a heart attack or a stroke. Because cortisol is a poison in the body, with the exception when it's used for about a couple minutes as a flight or fight response. We're meant to have cortisol rush when we need to get out of harm's way. But that's very short, like a minute, minute and a half, 2 minutes at the most. And that's why, for example, when you see a gazelle being chased by a tiger or a lion, the gazelle can run and leap very fast, but it only has about 2 minutes to make its getaway. Because after that, its cortisol wanes and it can no longer run as fast. And the lion, if it doesn't get its prey, its cortisol is burned out quicker. There's a relatively short period of time. And as a result, 80% of all attacks by big cats fail. Guess which is the most effective hunter as far as a hoofed, the alligator is in the water. It's the dogs, the wild dogs in Africa. They hunt in packs. They don't race after a prey, but they don't get tired because they're not coming from cortisol. They're just very methodical, and they just wear out a prey. Cortisol gone, then the prey is gone. So just imagine that you are acting out of anger, and we're not judging whether or not you are right in being angry. It is much better to realize that if I'm angry and I sustain this, and I'm rageful and I sustain it, I'm killing myself. You could be taking 10 years off your lifespan by being chronically angry. 10 years. Oh, and by the way, I won't deal with it today, but I'll deal with it this week, where the newest study just is, it's devastating. It's the worst news I've seen in public health for women's issue in memory. Women in the United States are living shorter lives now, big time shorter. We're talking about massively shorter lifespans. Other developed nations are not. The women are living longer lives. So I'm going to do a whole program, the whole hour, just on why are women now reversing their gains. And I mean, big reversals every year. That means a woman today could reasonably only expect to live into her mid-50s. So that's not good. And those who are in their 40s and 50s, wow, you'll be lucky to make it 65. So any day after that, unless you've been living a very de-stressed, healthy lifestyle, you're living on borrowed time. I'll deal with that on an upcoming program. So oxytocin we want around nature, hug a tree, sit by a stream, walk barefoot around the beach. Oxytocin time. Being with people that respect and love you, oxytocin time. Being angry, upset, cortisol time. One allows healing, the other speeds up your death. And yet people argue nonstop. I'm Gary Nall. That's the latest on health and healing. Oh, by the way, I did say it. I remember as a young boy, I remember going out into our garden. Ours was kind of like the not the most interesting garden. We had a neighbor who was just a master gardener. Everything just looked better, more butterflies and arbors and place to sit. And these were just normal size backyards and all on a block. And people pride themselves in their tomatoes and everybody shared vegetables. It was very nice. And that was when we actually ate some healthy food during the wintertime. I think there was a law you could not in West Virginia eat anything that was actually healthy from October until May, because everything was either frozen or out of a can. But I did see how when you went to the country, how things were different. And I do remember the most, when I visited my Aunt Myrtle's farm, which she ran herself, and she was a vegan, the only one in the family, they all thought she was nuts. And no one liked to be around her because she was a very strict disciplinarian. Boy, she wouldn't tolerate anything. And she was a little wiry woman. I loved being around her because I loved seeing all the things that she did. You know, I get a knock on the door, Gary Michael, time to get up. What time is it? 3:30. 3:30. I don't want to get up at 3:30. Time to get up. That's how strict she was. Need to say, that did not go over well with my father. He would never visit. But in any case, everything just was so magical. It was like Norman Rockwell painting of a farm. And that's how she lived. Well, think today. Think of what that generation, the greatest generation, born at the early part of the 1900s and were up through that period of time, through the Great Depression. My parents were born at that time. Think of what they gave us. Think of what we could use from them today. For example, supporting local farms. Doesn't it just make sense to get out and support something that's locally grown? It's fresher. You're helping a local economy. I'd rather see dollars spent locally with local farms and producers than to a national chain. You don't have to travel so far. That's one of the things I loved about New York. There's now many farmers markets, and you can walk down and look at the fresh produce that was just picked the night before or that morning and brought in. You're getting stuff that's fresher, that didn't have to travel. There's less waste because you're going to be more conscious of what you're buying. Fresher, better flavors, because the fresher it is, the more flavor it has. And also, you're going to have something that was grown in rich soil, healthy soil. And all that is good. And it just relating to people at the local farmer's market where they recognize you, you recognize them. It's a hi, a nod. What do you got? Here it is. A little chatter. And it's just a feel-good moment. You take back your bags, not plastic bags, paper bags. Put them in your cotton shoulder bag. And you walk back to your home. It just feels good. It's another one of those de-stressing, relaxing moments. From our environmental segment, oceans facing carbon rates which spurred mass die-off 250 million years ago, from Sarah Lazar from Common Dreams. Quote, In case you weren't already worried about the current and rapid acidification of the world's oceans, a new report by leading scientists finds that this very phenomena is to blame for the worst mass extinction event the planet Earth has ever seen, approximately 252 million years ago. The findings published this week in Science by University of Edinburgh researchers raise serious questions about the implications of present-day acidification driven by human-made climate change. Quote, scientists have long suspected that an ocean acidification event occurred during the greatest mass extinction of all time, but direct evidence has been lacking until now. This is a worrying finding, considering that we are already seeing an increase in ocean acidity today that is the result of human carbon emissions. And then it looks at the Permo-Triassic boundary mass extinction, which wiped out 90% of marine species and two-thirds of land animals, making it even more severe than the die-off of the dinosaurs. So what it means in lay language is this. When the ocean becomes acidic, the fish can't live. The food that fish live off of, like planktons and seaweeds, they can't live. As a result, fish starve to death. Smaller fish that eat larger fish. Larger fish are eaten by larger sillfish. The whole food chain is disrupted. Massive starvation. So now we have several phenomena. Now, I've been working on this documentary and major, major book for 7 years. So I'm acutely familiar with the science and the statistics. It's not just one problem. For example, when I went down to New Orleans, and I got to go down to New Orleans again in a month or two, I'm going to go up in a helicopter and I'm going to go as far down the Mississippi River as I can, showing historically, and I've already visualized how I'm going to do it. I'm going to have on the left side, you're seeing the Mississippi as it is today. And then I'm going to show all the chemicals from nitrogen fertilizers and glyphosate and all the other pesticides, herbicides, fungicides going into the Mississippi. Then I'm going to show the effects of massive soil erosion, meaning in the wintertime, there's no ground cover. You must always plant a green, what is called green fertilizer fixer, like soybeans. You grow organic soybeans in the fall, so it's green and covering the whole soil in the winter. But in the summer, in the spring, you till that under, and that becomes the nitrogen fixing in the soil so you don't have land erosion and you have good, healthy soil in the spring. But instead, we have one monocrop. It's harvested in the spring or summer, and it sets barren. Well, the snow comes. Rains come. The ground freezes. The ground thaws. Cracks, fissures. It all gets washed away into the tributaries and into the rivers. Then it all ends up down the mouth of the Mississippi. There is so much acidity that it creates what are called dead zones, meaning there's not enough oxygen to support aquatic life. And as a result, hundreds of millions or billions of fish in that area die. That means that the people in the bayou communities that historically have gone out to fish the Barrier Islands, they can't do that. They have to go way out. How far out? The size of New Jersey. That's how big that dead zone is at the base of Mississippi. But there are dead zones all over the world. Dozens and dozens of dead zones, thousands of miles, square miles. So our oceans are becoming so acidic from industrial pollution, from acid rain, from global warming, that when it hits a critical tipping point, you're going to see massive die-offs. We're already seeing massive die-offs. On this program, just 6 months ago, I read you in one show, over a 20-minute period, all the different massive fish kills, totaling billions of fish all over the world in just a two-week period. But it's becoming so common, it's not even reported anymore. Oh, you know, a million fish die here. You know, hundreds of thousands die here. We're only, you know, we only get the news when it's a whale or a bunch of dolphins. So that's why they had the big die-off. And that's where we're going to have another big die-off, except ours is happening a lot faster. Now, you want to know why the lobbyists in Washington, and you've got more lobbyists in Washington than you've got bacteria in human feces. And I compare the two, both politicians, every level, every rank, at every position, in every job, in every part of government, about the same aesthetic, intellectual, and spiritual quality as the bacteria in feces. I hope that gives you a very clear picture of what I think of politicians. I think they're sociopaths. There may be, and there are, of course, some exceptions. You could count them on one hand. And there are no exceptions that I've found in some places. The Justice Department, the IRS, and some other agencies, Homeland Security, the FBI, you name it. To me, our government now terrifies us, as you should be terrified. If you're not, then you're not paying attention. But inside the quarters of every place of power in Washington, and in every state capital, every local city council, you have lobbyists. They don't have to register anymore if they're not called lobbyists for foreign government, but if, let's say, they're just a consultant for a pharmaceutical company. But pharmaceutical companies are very smart. They don't just have one lobbyist who's a former senator or House member or president. The biggest lobbyist in the world, in world history, was Bill Clinton. He is also the wealthiest president in world history. He had collected more money after leaving office than all the other presidents of the United States combined for his foundation and for himself. So it pays. By the way, who in the world would pay $500,000 to have you come and give a speech that has nothing new, nothing relevant, except for people that you got rid of the pesky, let's say the pesky rules, or you got rid of the Glass-Steagall Act, or you implemented NAFTA or GATT, or you're trying to pass a Trans-Pacific Partnership, you're going to get a big payback. That's the quid pro quo. It won't be on any computer. There won't be any paper trail. But that's how it works in Washington, and we're all aware of that. And yet these are the people that you vote for. You vote for them. I don't. I won't vote for anyone who I know is so culpable of being compromised. Well, it's very tempting. No, it's not tempting. You can't tempt a spiritual person. You can't corrupt an uncorruptible person. It is so easy to corrupt and tempt a person that already has that temperament. Well, if you offer me enough money, yeah, then I'll compromise my values. What values? Jesus, man. We have such bad judgment. And yet these are the people who then tell the pharmaceutical companies, go forth. Here's the latest, J.D. Hayes from Natural News, quote, "In American politics, money equals speech. So it stands to reason that a lot of money equals a lot of speech. The U.S. Supreme Court, in its 2010 Citizens United versus Federal Electric Commission case, ruled as much. And it has led to, quote, unprecedented amounts of outside spending in elections since, according to Center for Responsive Politics. And while many applauded the high court's ruling as a victory for political free speech and the First Amendment, others have roundly criticized it as a ruling enshrining the notion that really, when all is said and done, American democracy is the best money can buy. The case, along with other legal developments, spawned the creation of super PACs, which can accept unlimited contributions from corporate union treasuries. And by the way, unions are just as corrupt when it comes to wanting to buy influence as non-unions. There's no sanctity there. It is at that level, it's power. And maybe they, in their minds, they consider it good, but it's still gaming the system against those who don't have that block of power. These groups spend $600 million. These are the lobbyists, $600 million in the last election cycle. It also triggered a boom in political activity by tax-exempt dark money organizations. So here's where it gets interesting. Quote, spending hundreds of billions of dollars collectively to push their preferred candidates, their preferred legal cases, and their preferred market positions, all in an attempt to win favor with federal government that has never been more for sale. And they gave an example here of the pharmaceutical industry. And here's what they came up with. And here are their actual figures. Quote, in particular, for every $1 million the industry spends to lobby lawmakers, it gets $77 billion in return. In particular, big pharma lobbies to prevent Medicare from bargaining for competitive drug prices so the taxpayers who foot the bill get a better deal. The Sunshine Foundation estimates that Medicare bargaining could save taxpayers $90 billion a year. And it goes on to talk about all the other industries that the more you give, the more money the people who gave get in return. So that's where we're at. And what would be the answer? No reform. I don't believe in reform. I don't believe in any reform. I don't believe reform's possible. I think it's stupid to even think reform. Because in this world, anyone who's a reformer is also corrupt. Just look at the people who said they were going to reform through whether it was the Dodd Amendment or the McCain Amendment, the election cycle. Everyone allows for loopholes that can then allow preferential people to evade responsibilities or be held to the same accountability as the rest of us. The only way you change this corruption is you outlaw all money. Not one single penny of money can come from anyone for any election at any level. How would you do that? It's relatively simple. You have lotteries. Anyone who wants to run for any office submits their bio, their curricula vitae, and their position on all major and relevant issues, what they feel, what they would support, what they would challenge, and then let the public decide. And then by random lottery, you allow these individuals to get into a race. You have 3 months, and then you have computer-matched debates. So it's not a Republican-Democrat, because both Republican and Democratic parties are so corrupt, they're so vile, they're so power hungry, and they control the networks. So you eliminate the whole idea that there's a Democrat Republican, and you allow just individuals. So everyone running runs as if they were independent. They may support a particular political ideology, but that ideology is not what's getting them elected. The people are. Then through a series of constant debates and constant interchanges where the public has a chance to ask the questions, not those that have been carefully selected and vetted by corporations that then give them to these polished little anchors that go on as if somehow these people have a brain. The public has a chance to tell them. And then you go through a series of reductions. You vote. It's reduced. You debate. You revote. You reduce until you end up with your persons for the office. And you give them one term. I believe term limits should only be 3 years. That's it. No matter what the office, you're there 3 years, you're gone, can never return again. And also, you're barred from working in certain industries that could be affected. So that way, we take all money out of politics. And then ban lobbying. I do not believe in capital punishment, but otherwise I would make it a capital offense. No lobbying. It's a federal offense to approach any legislator unless you are an individual there to represent your own interest. Then that's legitimate. That's what our legislators are there for. Otherwise, once you open that door, then you have all the corruption we now have that I just mentioned. And the more money they give, the more their interest, even if it's not everyone's interest. And if something's not of interest to everyone, then in and of itself shows a bias in the system. Back in a moment with my guest. Please stay with us.
Change.
Nice to have you with us, everyone. I'm Gary Nall. Let's go now down to North Carolina and say hello to Alan Phillips. Alan is a practicing attorney in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. He is the sole leading attorney in the entire country whose legal practice focuses on vaccine exemptions and vaccine waivers and activism. He is an advisory board member of the American Chiropractic Autistic Board, the World Association of Vaccine Education, and a co-founder of the North Carolina Citizens for Healthcare Freedom. He is also the author of The Alternative Guide to Vaccine Legal Exemptions, as well as Dispelling Vaccination Myths. Nice to have you with us today, Alan.
Real pleasure and honor to be back with you, Gary.
Alan, you may recall several months ago that Democracy Now! Had both attorney and Professor Mary Holland on its program with Paul Offit. And during that program, when Offit was questioned about his refusal to engage in a conversation with Professor Holland prior to the broadcast, Offit stated he refused to speak and debate a non-scientist. Now, this is an extremely dangerous stance for any scientist to take. Hubris aside, it is a dire warning that the vaccine agenda that is being force-fed across the nation is aligned with what the Nobel Prize-winning laureate Bertrand Russell warned as the emerging scientific dictatorship. Now, Russell, who was a leading philosopher and a thought thinker of the last century, always wrote against the tendency in science to feel it was absolutely certain about its findings, especially when it concerned policies that were to drive science. Back in 1953, Russell wrote in his profound book, The Impact of Science on Society, about the dangers of the future of scientism. Quote, diet, injections, and injunctions will combine from a very early age to produce the sort of character and the sort of beliefs that the authorities consider desirable, and any serious criticism of the powers will be psychologically impossible. Now, in an early work in 1931, Russell wrote, quote, perhaps by means of injections, meaning vaccines, drugs, and chemicals, the populations could be induced to bear whatever its scientific masters may decide to be for its good. So having stated that, one reason why the pro-vaccine science cartel has become so effective with pressing vaccine mandates and whittling away vaccine exemptions is because it operates in the shadows and refuses to openly debate experts in the anti-vaccination community about vaccine safety and efficacy. And they're bold when it comes to pushing policies and conflicts of interest, yet cowards when it comes to openly discussing vaccine science. And since you've been at the forefront in dealing with the legislators behind the rapid surge in repressive vaccine bills appearing in almost all 50 states, would you speak about how this cartel operates and your own experience with trying to debate them openly?
Well, Gary, I'm sure it's a unwritten rule that they absolutely refuse to debate. It doesn't matter whether they're debating a medical doctor, an attorney, or whomever, because if they debate, then they risk seeing the corruption be spotlighted. So they will always have an excuse. But there's another real interesting point that I think people miss on this issue. And while fundamentally vaccine questions are scientific questions, are they safe, are they effective, and so forth, the vaccine controversy is substantially a legal issue. These bills you just referred to all over the country, these bills give issues to all kinds of constitutional questions. For example, most of the bills out there and some of the exemption laws on the books already violate constitutional boundaries. Medical doctors are not competent or qualified to debate that issue, to understand that issue. We've got 140 attorneys in the country, Gary, who handle these vaccine exemption and vaccine injury and death cases. And, I mean, that's a real mixed bag. Sad that we need them, but wonderful that they're there to help those people. But those, of course, are cases that are managed by attorneys. And doctors may be expert witnesses, but the cases are managed by attorneys, and they're adjudicated by special masters, which is just a particular kind of judge for those cases. And the question about who has to get a vaccine and when and who can say no and how, those are all legal questions. Those are spelled out in the laws in all 50 states and U.S. territories and in federal law for some of the federal issues, immigration, military, federal civil rights law applies to the employee-required vaccines. All of these are legal issues. We could argue back that it's Offit who's not qualified or competent to debate the issue because he has no legal expertise.
Okay. For decades, Alan, I've been pushing forward with the scientific debate on whether or not vaccines are safe and effective. And the science is clearly on our side. There is no doubt about that, and the strongest supporting science that the pro-vaccine industry complex can come up with is a weak at best and relies almost solely upon epidemiological and population studies. However, just like trying to convince government officials and politicians, state legislators about the importance of genetically modified organisms, labeling them, or the scientific facts about anthropogenic climate change, unless the private corporate interests are removed from the equation and debate, scientific truth seems to barely make a dent, except for converting parents who are open and awake or who have an injured child from a vaccine. So where does the debate need to go? How best to undermine the David Gorskys and Bill Gates and the CDC and the vaccine cartels?
Well, it's a really difficult arena because, as you were talking about earlier, you know, he who has the money makes the rules is quite the applicable principle here. But I think where the rubber meets the road primarily, and there are several places we could say that that occurs, but I think primarily is in the state legislatures. The federal government does not have authority to mandate vaccines for state residents directly, and that's why the vaccines required for school and daycare enrollment, for example, are in each individual state and territory around the country, and the exemptions similarly are there at the state level. So we need to be educating our state representatives. Now, some of them are bought and paid for. There was a study coming out of Princeton recently that concluded that the average American has zero influence on federal policy, that that's really dominated and controlled by the wealthy elite. I don't think that's nearly so much the case at the state level, though. There are some state representatives that seem to have their minds made up on this and perhaps other issues, and it doesn't matter what research, facts, statistics, and so forth you show them. They're going to do whatever they're going to do, but not all of them. And I have found myself, and I have heard back from other people, and I work with vaccine legislative activists all over the country, that at least some of the legislators can hear what we have to say. And I've been looking at this issue as a layperson, Gary, for over 20 years, 21 years now, and I'm not a scientist, but all the information I see supports and corroborates what you just said, that the science is just not there to support vaccines. And that is why you won't see people in the vaccine cartel, as you referred to it so aptly, willingly stepping up to the plate and saying, sure, we'll debate. If they didn't have anything to hide, they wouldn't care who they debated. If somebody wasn't qualified, they'd want to debate all the more just so they could wipe up the floor with them. But they know they will be the ones tucking their tails and running if they actually have an open and fair debate. So that's why it's not going to happen.
We've invited the leading pro-vaccine advocates and organizations at least 20 times to come on the show and debate me, no one else. They won't do it. Then I ask for a panel. All right, let's put together a panel, yourself included, and Dr. Tony Bark and Dr. Sam Humphreys, people who spent thousands of hours studying the scientific literature, who are familiar with every single study on safety and efficacy of vaccines. We know we will win the debate because we have truth and the real science on our side. They know they're going to lose the debate, so they just stay out of it. They don't need to embarrass themselves when all they have to do is have a sit down with the legislator, promise campaign money or some other benefit, and they're in and we're out. What is your final thought of what should we do as citizens who are concerned that if we do not become proactive, then they will end up passing mandated bills? And if they're going to start with children, I promise you behind that are going to be adults.
They're already working on adults. Gary, as you know, hospital workers around the country, every year a whole new wave of hospitals comes on board with influenza mandates, get the shot or lose your job, and there are literally hundreds of new vaccines in development. So it's the agenda is playing out incrementally, one step at a time. It seems to have been accelerating in recent years and recent times. I think we've lost the mainstream media. I say we don't spend any time or energy there. People are moving more and more to alternative media anyway. We need to keep the conversation alive, as you have so wonderfully done, not just talking about it, but doing extensive research yourself. And I have just the utmost admiration for your work in this arena and all the work that you do over the many, many years. But there, as you started naming others who have done this research as well, there are more and more doctors who are recognizing what's going on and stepping up to the plate, and many others who know what's going on and are trying to protect themselves and being quiet. But there are many more of us than a lot of us realize. And minorities of people who get active can make a difference. I once stopped a bill here in North Carolina just by writing a letter, and I couldn't go to the legislative hearing, but somebody else took my letter to the hearing and read it at the hearing, and it stopped a bill. Who would have thought that one person who didn't even show up could stop a bill? So you never know what one person or a small group of people can do, but we cannot sit around saying, oh my gosh, what's happening? We've got to be involved in the legislative process. And there are two great sources I know to help people do that. People can go to my website, vaccinerights.com, and right at the top on the homepage is a link to my legislative projects page. I've got legal analyses there that people can use, take to their representatives, and explain why some of these bills that are sitting in legislatures around the country are unconstitutional and need to be either fixed or withdrawn. Other cases, just persuasive arguments and information there about how to be effective legislatively. But people can also go to the NVIC Advocacy Portal, and that website is nvicadvocacy.org. NVICAdvocacy.org, and those are both sources for learning more about how to be legislatively active and how to be effective in doing it, and I'm here to help anyone in the country with whatever's going on in their state.
Thank you very much, Alan, and we will be in the next 2 weeks putting together every major vaccine article that we consider scientific and relevant so that no matter who the author is, and there are a lot of different authors, yourself included, there will be hundreds of articles that people can educate themselves and documentaries, all the important documentaries in the field we intend to include, so they'll be able to get educated and then start becoming politically active. Thank you very much, Alan.
Thank you for having me. Keep up the great work.
Alan Phillips, and his website is vaccinerights.com. We're out of time. I'm Gary Noll. Thank you all for listening. We'll look forward to seeing you tomorrow.
Backfield in motion. Yeah.